Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Society Pages podcast. The Society Pages is an organization that works to bring social sciences research to you. Make sure to check us out online and follow us on social media. We have a special guest and interview to share with you. Natasha Wariku is Lenore Stern Professor in the Humanities and Social Sciences Department of Sociology at Tufts University. A former Guggenheim Fellow and high school teacher, Wariku is an expert on racial and ethnic inequality in education. Prior to her academic career, she was a teacher in New York City's public schools and also spent time working at the U.S. Department of Education. Today, we'll be having a discussion with Wariku about one of her most recent books, Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. Her research for the book illuminates tensions related to achievement and emotional well-being in a suburban, high-income town with a large and growing Asian American population. Our undergraduate and graduate student interviewers, Nicole Schmidtgen, Caroline Gartland, and Mason Jones, sat down with Dr. Wariku to discuss the book and the extensive research behind it. So without further ado, the Society Pages podcast is happy to present A Discussion on Race at the Top by Natasha Wariku.
So one of the first questions that we wanted to ask before we got into kind of more of the specifics of your book was about the concept of race. Race is widely discussed and researched in different fields, but we were curious about how you view race through a sociological lens and what that might mean exactly.
Yeah, that's a great question. And we tend to be very binary about, like, either, racial differences are all about culture, and often people end up subscribing to these very stereotypes about, you know, culture of poverty or model minority, which are problematic. Or, you know, the other view is, culture doesn't matter at all. It's all institutions. It's all, you know, social policy. It's all like economic resources. And I think that's wrong too. We can say, well, do we see patterns? And what explains those patterns? How do people make sense of them? How are they related to like the amount of financial resources someone has? How are they related to who's in their network, who they're connected to, what school they go to? So I think we can answer questions using data, questions about race that are often thorny using data, and that helps. And I think that can be very helpful. So that's the sort of promise of the sociological approach to race that I think is really exciting.
Yeah, so sort of jumping off of what you were talking about and the use of data and stuff like that, I think a lot of times in sociology or in sociological data, people might jump over the Asian population when talking about race and just sort of classify it as part of this other category. We really appreciated that your book focuses on Asian parents and children, individuals. You mentioned it a little bit, but what do you think of the idea of Asians being the model minority? How is this represented in your book? And how have Asians and been characterized and stereotyped in this way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And part of the motivation for writing this book was that there has just, so I'm Asian American, full disclosure, I think I say that in the book, but you know, there's been this massive increase in the Asian American population in the United States, and we see it all around the country, right? And so, you know, it's doubled over the last two decades in your lifetimes, right? And so, and we can see that, so that's just the population. And then I think it's also increased representation. And I think obviously that's not a coincidence, right? In media and film, like this is a very different world than the one that I grew up in the United States. This idea of the model minority goes pretty far back to the 1970s. And it's this idea, you know, that here is a minority group that has experienced some success in American society, right? That Asian American kids, on average, obviously there's a lot of variation, but on average tend to do better than other groups, including whites, academically. So if we look at, you know, average SAT scores, if we look at, some of the state tests that kids take, if you control for their parents' education, their parents' income, you'll see that Asian Americans tend to do well. Now, this has sometimes been used to denigrate other racial minorities, to say, well, here's a group that's not white and they're doing well, so it must be cultural, right? They care more about education. Well, you know, African Americans, Latinx families, if they just cared about education and put their heads down and work hard, then they can make it. And Asian Americans, quote unquote, prove that. And that's that logic. Now, that logic is faulty, right? Because when you dig in, you see that part of what is happening is we have something called selective migration, right? Who comes to the United States from Asia? The two biggest sending countries are China and India, and that's been for a long time. Because of U.S. immigration policy, it's the easiest way to come to the United States from those countries is through being a highly skilled immigrant. That is, you get a visa because of this, you know, an employer wants to hire you, often, you know, in a STEM field or in tech, or you're coming for graduate school, right? Which means obviously you have a college degree. So Asian immigrants, over half of Asian immigrants have a college degree. And, you know, compared to one in three people who are born in the United States. So this is what we call highly selective, right? So it's not a cross section of people from India and China and that they're just inherently better at school. It's that the policy leads to a particular group of people coming to the United States, and you know they are bringing certain skills in, an education that got them far in those countries. And that's what actually landed them in the United States. So that is a big part of the story of Asian kind of academic success, Asian American academic success. This idea of model minority. So there's an article that I feel like we need to revive by a woman named Claire Kim that came out in 1999, where she talks about this idea of racial triangulation, that there are racial stereotypes of different groups and they're different, right? So there are stereotypes of, you know, she talks in that piece about African-Americans and Asian-Americans. And they kind of feed off of each other, right? So the model minority stereotype feeds off of other negative stereotypes about Black Americans, right? That, you know, if Asian Americans are, you know, highly competent, education focused, Black Americans don't care about education, not very smart, you know, this kind of culture, and that they feed, and then Asian Americans also are seen as like foreign, outsiders, not kind of American. Whereas I think African Americans, she talks about, are seen as part of the United States. But, you know, this, so there are these different stereotypes in different domains, both of which are harmful, and they affect each other. And, you know, so we need to talk about race in more nuanced ways, just rather than POC and white, right?
Yeah. So for this research, you conducted an ethnography in Woodcrest. Now, Woodcrest, of course, isn't the actual name of the town, just a pseudonym for privacy reasons. But this ethnography that you conducted, it allowed you to kind of look into the lives of the individuals living in Woodcrest and really kind of learn more about the culture and the people there. Do you think that you could explain to our audience what an ethnography is and then its role in sociological research?
Yeah. So ethnography to me is, you know, at a sort of very broad level, is really looking at a particular case or maybe two cases to ask bigger questions, right? So it kind of goes back to our earlier discussion about, you know, a case study, right? What are you getting from a case study? And, you know, what I should have said then as well is that, you know, as a reader, you might gain certain insights, or you might think, oh, this kind of fits like this other situation, or this situation is different. So it invites a reader to sort of say what resonates here and what doesn't, and what are the kind of mechanisms that are operating in a way that's harder to do with more quantitative data. Now, the truth is that these are kind of ideal types, the quantitative over here and the qualitative over here. And there's really, you know, to me, it's a continuum. But ethnography, you know, there's participant observation, where you're really trying as much as possible to be a fly on the wall and just see what's happening, human behavior, what are people doing, how are they interacting, and using your kind of understanding, sociological understandings, to make sense of that, right? And then there's in-depth interviews, where you have a set of questions, sit down with someone and dig into how do they make meaning of things, right? How do they make sense of, like, what they're doing. You know, my classic example of this, this was my dissertation project. I was doing a school study, a study of two schools, one in New York and one in London. And in London, I remember I had interviewed this young man who was not a great student in school. And we were talking and he was, you know, he really felt like he wanted to change his behavior. He was like, you know, I used to cut class. I used to not do my work, but I'm changing. I want to do things differently. It's really important. School is really important to me. And I'm a new person. And then, you know, later that day, I happened to be in one of his classes. And I saw him get up and start like clowning around as kids do. And I was like, okay, now I think, you know, we have to reconcile these two things, right? I believed him and he felt sincere and I was not his teacher. He was not in trouble with me. We were just talking and I believe that he believed those things, right? And then I see behavior, which is a contradiction to what he said. And I kind of looked at him and I just kind of on a whim, probably not supposed to do this as a researcher, but I was like, you just told me that, you know, you don't want to do this. And he kind of looked at me sheepishly and he went and he sat down. To my surprise, I thought he was going to like, you know, get mad at me or something, but I use that example because I think it helps you see how we behave is not always indicative of what we believe and what we want. And I think that's an important distinction. And I think getting a kind of 360 view, an ethnography that can both look at people's behavior and the meaning they make of that behavior, I think is incredibly important. And so I think it can encompass all of these things. But more broadly, ethnography is really about going deep and narrow rather than broad and, you know, more surface level. Now, and again, I don't think it's better than, you know, a survey that really helps us see broad patterns, but I think they can really work in, you know, in conversation with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you. That was a great explanation of ethnography in your research. And it also makes me more curious about your methods. And so a question that I wanted to ask, and I know you touch on this a little bit in your book, but how exactly did you choose Woodcrest as the site of your research? I'm sure there was plenty of places that you could have picked from, but what was it about Woodcrest specifically that you felt would be a good place to do this kind of research?
Find a community with a large and growing Asian American population, and that's high income. So these are highly skilled immigrants because, you know, Asian Americans are also the fastest growing undocumented population. But I wanted to sort of look at these questions from a kind of elite or upper middle class perspective. So I looked at some of the data because I like data at towns around the country, and I found almost three dozen communities that fit this bill that have a large and growing Asian American population and that are in the top income quintile. So, you know, that means that the median household income in that community is well over $100,000 a year. And so I know that these communities exist all over the country, and then found one community to kind of dig into, to sort of say, like, let's look at the particular, really dig in to see if we can find patterns that are common to a lot of places. And that's sort of the sort of angle that I took.
And we were just really fascinated in the book about just how you found these two kind of very distinct parenting styles that were kind of in conflict, essentially, with one another. And so with that, we wanted to ask about, you know, just if you could just explain that for others that maybe haven't read your book about what these conflicts were, if you can give a brief summary. And then we were also just wondering, you know, in your book, you do a lot of self-reflecting. Has your, you know, after writing the book, has your thoughts on these parenting styles changed, or like, are they similar still? Or like, yeah, after maybe getting feedback or something from the book, we were kind of just wondering what your thoughts were on that, on if they're similar or not. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So in this community, I spent a lot of time in the high school and interviewing kids and going to a lot of community events and school events. And then I started talking to parents, and the parents were fascinating. And the book ends up focusing much more on the parents, although that's not how the project started out. And this is, again, it's like, where does the data take you? Right. And, you know, sometimes what you plan is not ends up It does not end up what comes out on the other end. And what I found was that parents had very different ways of talking about how to help their children get ahead. And this kind of resonated with what the kids were doing, right? So, you know, we've all been teenagers. We don't always listen to what our parents tell us to do, but they do have an influence. And they did seem to shape these patterns of behavior that I saw in the students. And so Asian parents, these were the people I interviewed, and most of the Asian Americans in this community were Chinese American or Indian American. And most of the parents were immigrants themselves, came as adults. And so to the United States. So they tended to focus much more on academics. And that was sort of the central focus. They would say things like, well, there was one mom who said, you know, I kept telling my son to quit the swim team. He didn't, right? But I told him, quit the swim team. You're not getting your homework done. It's too much. And, you know, swimmers, I don't know if you know any swimmers in high school, but it's a lot, right? Swimming is exhausting. I don't know. That's me. And they're doing, you know, lots of hours in the pool. And so I kind of got that. This child was taking a lot of honors and AP classes. He went on to a very selective college. So it was okay that he didn't quit. He did just fine. But that was her, and I think a lot of Asian parents' perspective, like the academics absolutely come first. I talk about this as their cultural repertoire, right? So Ann Swidler has this idea of cultural repertoires that are kind of ways of dealing with the world that we gain from, you know, from childhood, from our neighbors, from the kids we go to school with, these ways of being. How do you deal with a particular situation? So a situation in which limited hours in the day, intensive school, what are you going to do? Focus on the academics. And in a way, it's because these immigrant parents, they came from education systems in which the only thing that matters for your success is how you do on the national exam, right? And it's, you know, routine to for young people who are in, you know, resource families to be going to tutoring, right? You go to school and then you go to tutoring for the national exams. And these parents are, you know, that's how they got to where they are. So they live in Woodcrest because they did well in those education systems. They know how to do well on standardized tests, right? Because they had to do, they are the ones who did it, were able to do it. And then that's what got them to this town and got them the high incomes and enabled them to afford to live in this town. So that's their strategy based on what they grew up with. Now, the white parents were slightly different. The Asian parents got that college admissions is different in the US. Their kids also have to do extracurriculars, but it was like, you know, don't do the swim team, like volunteer at the hospital once a week or something.
Yeah, it was like more, significant.
Less intensive, yeah. Whereas some of the white parents, obviously cared about academics, wanted their kids to do well in school, but they use this word balance a lot, right? I want my child to have balance. And there were multiple families who told me that they told their kids, you can only take one AP or honors class per semester because it's too much. You want to do two varsity sports this year. You're in theater. When come production time, you're not going to have time to do all that homework. We don't want you stressed out, right? So all these parents cared about, like, there's only so many hours in the day. I want my kid to get a good night's rest. The Asian parents were more likely to ask their kids to give up the extracurriculars. The white parents wanted their kids to give up like crazy, you know, advanced classes. And I think, again, that's their cultural repertoire in part because that's college admissions in the United States. Like they kind of understood intuitively, like, and they had a preference for, you know, finding a quote unquote passion and developing your passion. And that's part of our kind of rhetoric in the United States. And so they had that. And that led to some tensions around, you know, there were all these worries about mental health. And this was pre-pandemic. We were already in a mental health crisis. Yes. And they were concerned about that. But they had different ways. So a lot of the white parents were like, the school needs to reduce homework. We need a new homework policy. They had already pushed for stop. They stopped naming a valedictorian. They stopped naming class rank. So these were areas where Asian Americans were kind of, you know, shining. And so like dampening that competition. Yeah. Whereas the Asian parents were like, well, my kid is not, your kid was at sports and extracurriculars to 9 p.m. and then, you know, had to do their homework. So they're stressed. My kid is not doing that. So my kid's not stressed. So why are you trying to change the policy for my kid? Let's just, you do you and we'll do us. So that was some of the tension around, like, how do we, you know, protect our children's emotional health in ways that allows for different ways of parenting and different ways of kind of getting ahead.
And so we were just kind of interested, like, do you see these trends, like, with homework or the fear of homework and kids' mental health? Do you see this kind of being a growing trend or, like, and yeah, and what are your thoughts on this homework debate?
Yeah. To me, the interesting question as a sociologist was, like, you know, we need to understand why these parents have such different perspectives. So some of these Asian parents, you know, there is a lot of homework and a lot of test prep. If you're, again, you know, a high achiever and have family resources in India and China, and it's a grind. And so a lot of these parents were like, we didn't want that for our child. That was part of the reason we came to the United States, not the only reason. And so for them, being in a town like Woodcrest, their kids still had a lot less work than they ever did. So they saw this as less. Whereas, you know, some of the white parents were like, this is crazy compared to what I had as a kid. So it's all kind of, you know, related to our cultural repertoire as well. So
to any parents reading this book, because you talk a little bit about parenting, your own experience, and also a main focus of your book are parents and how they see their kids' lives playing out. To any parents reading this book, what would you hope they get out of your work or what you discovered?
So one thing that I hope parents will see, it will get, is an appreciation for how our lived experiences shape how we parent. Yeah. And that, and I really try to sort of emphasize that these are cultural and one is not necessarily better than the other, right? We might have our own proclivities, but that we should not be judging other parents for their own parenting. So I talk a lot about this moral boundary making that I saw in this town. And I think that's harmful. I think it's harmful to communities. I think it's, you know, it's problematic because it's assuming things about other communities and, you know, especially when it falls along racial lines. And I think the second thing that I hope people, parents, particularly who live in communities like Woodcrest, or, you know, I think of private schools as well, like that this concentration of well-resourced families in a community. Now, you know, Woodcrest wasn't all well-resourced families. They also had some busing students. And I know in private school, you know, there are often scholarships, but this concentration of well-resourced families is what creates these tensions in the first place, right? Because kids are in an environment in which, you know, almost all of the adults are very high achievers and have high incomes. And it becomes like the norm, right? You think that's like normal. That's not normal, right? One in three American adults has a bachelor's degree. That's like, it's normal not to have a college degree as an adult in this country. And so and I think it creates this like ever, like this pressure to achieve higher and higher levels, whether it's in academics or sports or music or whatever domain. And, you know, people can feel that pressure and then be upset about that pressure, but it's like, well, part of it is that you're kind of concentrating the resources in one place. So I think we need like more integrated communities, both in terms of race and class. I think we need to advocate for more mixed income housing in these kinds of communities. And so, you know, look more beyond, like look, stop being so insular and look beyond our communities, I think is another, and how we can not be so separate from, you know, the rest of society.
Yeah. And I guess I was wondering, for people who are interested in sociology, how would you recommend people look back at their own educational experiences and view it through a sociological lens?
So I teach a class on sociology of education. And one of the first assignments that I give students is to, you know, we're sort of a third of the way into the semester, is to take some of the, reflect back on their own. I call it a schooling autobiography. I should call it a sociological schooling autobiography, is to take the insights and to think about how that helps you make sense of your own schooling. Because, you know, we tend, I mean, this is not just, this is everybody, right? We tend to look at our lives as very individual. I made this decision. I did this. I did that. And people who do well, explain it by, well, I worked really hard and I got here. And even people who don't do well, it's my own fault, right? I had a doctoral student who did her dissertation on interviewing young men who had been in the criminal justice system before the age of 18. And so much of what they said was, I did this, I did that, I got in trouble. And, you know, one day she said, well, where were there the adults in their lives? Like, and what she saw was failure after failure of the adults in their lives to take care of them, to meet their needs, to, you know, provide, you know, and, you know, whether that was family or the social services or the school, all of these different institutions, but they didn't see that. So I think it goes both, whether, you know, we're successful or bad things happen, we tend to blame ourselves. And I think, what I hope students will do is be able to look beyond their individual behavior and desires and actions to understand how, you know, class and race and gender and the community, how all of these things, like school policy, culture, how these shaped their own biographies as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting. And it definitely makes me want to look back at my own educational experiences and see the different influences within that. And kind of continuing on with the conversation about culture, is there kind of a takeaway about culture that you'd like readers to have from your book, Race at the Top?
With the book, I want people to understand the ways that culture shapes what we think is, quote unquote, the right way to parent or to do things, and that it's so cultural specific, and that we should be a little more recognize how people do things differently. And it's not because we value different things or want different things or care about different things most of the time. You know, all these surveys on parents about, do you want your kids to go to college? Do you care about education? Is education important to you? We see very big similarities between racial groups, class groups, but what people do and what, you know, resources they have and how they're able to enact those dreams is very different. And that's, you know, that's something that runs across the projects that I've done in sociology. And I think this one as well. And with this conversation, I hope that people will kind of try out sociology, because I feel like it has a lot to offer in terms of understanding the world, methods for understanding the world that I think are really useful in, you know, whatever you're interested in. The nice thing is you can study so many different things in sociology. So,
Kelly, thank you so much.
Again, thank you so much for being here and for talking with us today. And before we wrap things up, I wanted to ask a few just kind of random questions. And so the first one is, if there were to be an audiobook created of Race at the Top, who would you want to be the one narrating it or doing the speaking?
I would love for one of the students in the school, or maybe a graduate, to do the audiobook. And maybe listeners would not necessarily know that, but I would know that, and that would feel like a that would be kind of very meaningful to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great answer. And I think it seems really fitting that one of the students, you know, in the research gets to kind of tell that story. I think that's wonderful. Okay, so for my next question, now this is, if you could pair a food or a drink with your book, now what would it be? You know, so your reader sits down after a long day, they're going to crack open your wonderful book. What would you suggest they either eat or drink with it?
I'm going to go have to go with like Indian or Chinese food, because those are, you know, maybe Chinese takeout, because in a way it's, to me, Chinese takeout is about like the influence of Chinese culture in the United States on, you know, on a somewhat, it's a somewhat superficial level, but I think it's become our kind of go-to takeout in a way in the United States. But it also shows the way that immigrant cultures come and they, you know, become part of the United States. They change, right? I'm sure, I'm not Chinese, but I'm sure that the food you get at Chinese takeout in the United States is not the same as the food you get in China, but it's a blend. And so I would say that. And then to drink, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Society Pages podcast. Special thank you to our brilliant guest, Natasha Wariku. You can find her book, Race at the Top, at any major book retailer online or in person. If you'd like to listen to the unedited version of the interview, check out our website, The Society Pages. You'll find the interview and any resources mentioned during the discussion link there.
This has been the Society Pages podcast, produced by the Society Pages Student Board, in affiliation with the American Sociological Association.